Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleri Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz for Money and Markets. We're recording on Wednesday, March 6th for publication on March 7th. And tell us our theme. Boy, is our theme dead on.
The theme is life in the land grab. And that's exactly wow. Right.
Everywhere I go, everybody I talk to is feeling and experiencing the land grab. And the good news is they get it. They understand what's going on. They understand it's war. They understand it's a scam, and they're fighting and making progress. So I feel
the progress part is that's good to hear.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the challenge is you can't win by playing defense. So I would say the American people are doing a much better job at defense than I've ever seen before, but that's not enough. We got to do offense too.
Right. Right. But so, I say that's good because, you know, saying that people are becoming aware, that's kind of subjective. If they're making progress and bills are getting passed, that's a different matter. That's more objective. That's a great sign.
From what I'm seeing all over the place, bills are getting stopped. So, okay. You know, Mr. Global's coming in with really, you know, dangerous stuff that used to sell, you know, like what they're doing with conservation easements. And now it's getting stopped because people realize, and it was funny because one of the big issues in Tennessee on the conservation easements is they won't go longer than 15 years. And suddenly the bankers are saying, no, we need them in perpetuity, which tells you a little secret about what they're really up to.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. That does. I would count Mr. Global getting tackled as progress, even if it is defensive.
Mr. Global's getting tackled.
That's
Global's
awesome.
Getting tackled. Yep.
More tackling. I love it.
Oh, and we were in Raleigh. So you came out and met with a great group of subscribers. Tell us about it.
We met in Raleigh. There was 36 subscribers came in. Uh-huh. We met from, it was scheduled from 7 to 9. It went to about 10:30,
right?
If memory serves. Right. And it was a really robust group. Lots of great questions, lots of great comments. And it was just good to meet people like-minded to be able to talk freely.
Right. And one of the primary goal here is for people in one area to meet each other. And I think there were a lot of people there who met other like-minded people. You know, I'm always hearing, why are there no like-minded people around? And I'm like, my whole life is surrounded by like-minded people. It's full of like-minded people. You just got to go find them. They're there.
Yeah, and a big thanks to Terry, who spearheaded this whole thing. Organizing something like that that's a big undertaking. It's harder than it looks.
It is a big undertaking. Right. And he did a great job.
He did.
Anyway. Yeah. Okay, let's dive in.
Okay, greatly appreciated, Terry. Okay, let's dive in with genocide in Gaza. This first story is from Business Insider. I'm going to have to switch the view real quick because it doesn't play nice with my browser, but you can see Business Insider. There we go. It's Israel may have just torched its relationship with Russia, promising to supply Ukraine with early warning systems. So what's going on here? Let's scroll down. Israel's permanent representative to the UN said the country was working to provide Ukraine with early warning systems. Okay, so that's kind of bad, but this is the tell to me. Such systems would help save civilian lives from Russia's indiscriminate missile and drone attacks. So Israel's taking off the gloves here, going with the anti-Russian propaganda. We'll talk more about that in a little bit, but let's scroll down. So for the past 2 years, Israel has walked a diplomatic tightrope in Russia-Ukraine war. So it's tried to play the middle of the road. But it has consistently stopped short of sending military aid or joining Western sanctions, in part because it doesn't want to provoke Russia. Well, that's changed. That changed big time. Now Israel's firmly on Israel's side. The announcement comes as Russia hosts an intra-Palestinian meeting in Moscow this weekend. Representatives of Hamas and Islamic Jihad will be welcomed in the Russian capital to help the various Palestinian forces agree to unite politically, Russia's foreign minister told state-run news agency TASS. That was too much for Israel, which will now take a more aggressive stance against Russia from now on. That's a big shift.
Right, but it's not their best early warning system. You know, this is the grade B early warning system.
Right. They're, so why do that? I mean, if you're gonna if you're gonna go with Russia, you got to go chips all in. So you're right. It's not their best. It's not their Iron Dome. It's their junior varsity system.
Right. This is not chips all in. I mean, here's the reality. Russia is a commodity producer. It's organizing with the other commodity producers. There's nothing Israel can do to stop that.
Right. Nothing they can do to stop that. That's exactly right. But so Russia, you know, that, I mean, Israel for a long time, like you saw, was middle of the road. And now it's like, I don't know what they're thinking, because remember, we saw this week, Victoria Nuland is out. That's not a good sign for Ukraine. So why Israel is making this bet against Russia at this stage in the game, it just seems foolhardy to me.
I don't know. You know, the ties between Netanyahu and that group and Russia are very, very deep. So, and as you know, I think that group wants to take over the Ukraine, so they have a vested interest in Russia helping clean the place out. So
could
I just
be.
Think that, I think whatever the relationships are, they're much more complex and deep than we understand.
Probably, so, but the threshold question is, what does Israel get out of supplying Ukraine with weapon systems like this?
So with Netanyahu on the ropes and other cabinet members going to Washington and Nuland out, who was a great Netanyahu ally, I think they're putting lipstick on the, you know, trying to appease the U.S. for some reason. That's what it looks like to me.
Could be. It could also be making a little bit of money on a kind of a grade B weapon system.
That's a good point, because I don't think this, an early warning system for civilians doesn't hurt the Russians.
No.
It doesn't hurt the Russians.
That's laughable. They're laughing at this.
Right. So.
So you may be right. That's the best speculation I've heard yet, really, is that it appeases the Americans.
Okay. So you want some high
gesture.
You want some high octane speculation?
Please.
I think Israel's up to their eyeballs in the bio labs. And with Nuland out, they need a pretty headline. They need a good face. They need lipstick.
Wow. Okay. Right. Well, we will get to the biolabs in due course.
Right.
There's a bunch of them. But for now, let's turn to the comment you made earlier, just a few seconds ago, Netanyahu on the ropes. Look at this next story. This is from Thierry Meyssan. We covered him a lot before, and this is...
He's good. He's really good.
He's good, but the Meyssan article takes a little bit of an explanation, but it's worth it. Okay, this is from voltairenet.org. Netanyahu on borrowed time. All right, what are we talking about here? The story sort of picks up with Biden. He tried one last time to talk Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu into agreeing to a six-week ceasefire, but yet Netanyahu dug his heels in, confirmed his intention to continue the war and attack Rafah. Biden was stunned, called him an a-hole. That's kind of strong.
I want you to know that's not the first president who's called Netanyahu that. I don't know if you remember when he basically came to Washington without an invitation from Obama. Obama didn't want him there, and he addressed Congress without the support of the president, and Obama was livid. And it was outrageous, because that's Netanyahu's totally outrageous.
Yeah, well, it shows you that Netanyahu knows where U.S. presidents stand in the scheme of things.
Yes, that's true.
Right.
That's true.
With real Article II powers, he would never do that. Anyway,
right. Let's
go back to this story. We covered this earlier on Money and Markets, was the U.N. Agency for Relief Aid, mm-hmm. and Israel accusing it of having Hamas terrorists in it and all the rest. They went a bridge too far. Okay. Israel, after calling for the agency to be dissolved, 12 of its employees had allegedly taken part in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The IDF, Israel, claimed that Hamas had set up its headquarters in a tunnel under UNRWA's Gaza headquarters. That's the relief agency there under the UN. The agency was preparing to close its doors, but between Joe Biden and other countries, with the closing of the doors was too much, the Anglo-Saxon turnaround changed the mood. Some countries restored their funding to the UNRWA, while Iran called for calm. And guess what? Attacks on U.S. military bases suddenly became rare. What was going on is the Middle East heavyweights Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Iran put their differences on the back burner, and now they're coming together to face the enemy of them all, the revisionist Zionists who make up
there
stories about a Erdogan, get this, traveled to Egypt to meet his counterpart, El-Sisi, with whom he had previously refused to speak. So they bury the hatchet, they get together into talking. Egypt urgently organized a vast camp capable of accommodating 1 million Gazans in Sinai.
This is extraordinary.
This is. So they're getting together. They're putting together. If you're going to expel them, we got to put them somewhere. We'll put them. We'll set up a camp. So they're setting up this camp. The group is due to complete the earthworks and fencing on February 23rd. The Palestinians could be allowed to flee Israeli bombs and take refuge there. No one, says Misan, wants to see the Palestinians expelled from their land. So everyone is planning what to do next, how to topple Benjamin Netanyahu and the revisionist Zionists who surround him. We can therefore expect a political cataclysm in Israel in the coming weeks. Wow. We'll see.
I told you when I was in Raleigh, and I'll say it again, it is astonishing how many people on the pro-Israel side do not realize that Netanyahu in the last 3 years has killed more Israelis than Palestinians. So, you know, there are multiple genocides going on at the same time, and Netanyahu is, in my opinion, at the heart of all of them.
And yeah, he really is. He really is.
Right, and I believe he's at the heart of the Ukraine, too. So, you know, whether it's Ukraine, Gaza, or the COVID operation, you know, and I'll go back to 9/11 because I just think Netanyahu's, and that's why it's so important that Newland is out, because Newland was their air cover at State, and State is arguably State and Treasury the most important apparatus. And if you look at the, if you take a look at the cabinet and you just make a guess, you know, my best guess as to how many people have dual passports, you know, Newland is a big chink in Netanyahu's armor. And there's some others, too.
Yeah.
So I think finally the world is saying, you know, it's a relatively small group of people who are our problem, and we have to deal with that group of people. It's a syndicate. And here we go.
Newland out is that's a bellwether event.
Right.
I mean, her lifelong dream has been, let's just see the defeat, the military defeat of Russia, and the world hegemon takes over. And after 2 years of propaganda, Ukraine winning, she's so close to getting her gold. She's so close. And then she leaves?
Right.
Okay, so, well, I guess it was 2 years of pure propaganda and lies, and she now sees it's impossible, and she's out. Wow.
Right. I just want everybody watching Antarctica to, you know, keep an eye out. If Newland goes to Antarctica, then, then we're really in trouble.
I think, like, Georgetown's a likelier destination for Toria,
if you were
as
Newland,
they call her.
If you were Newland, where would you go?
To a university, to a sinecures.
I wouldn't want to be Newland walking down the street for the next 10
D.C.?
Years.
Are you kidding me? You should be totally safe.
Maybe. We'll see.
Okay, but you mentioned Ukraine. Let's turn our attention to Ukraine and see what's going on there. This is more like bell ringer news here. NATO in trouble. NATO in hot water. What does Bundeswehr's Crimean bridge strike discussion leak means. So what's going on here? German officials discussing an attack on Crimea bridge, right? A transcript, the audio was leaked. The Russian Foreign Ministry has demanded an immediate explanation from Berlin on the audio recording released earlier this week by Margarita Simonyan, editor-in-chief of RT. Okay, the officials are openly discussing destroying the Crimean bridge. Now, the question is, if Berlin was in the know, says Russia, it can be likened to a declaration of war, urging Moscow and Berlin to use diplomatic channels to this is an expert they're quoting. That's like a foreign policy wonk. If Berlin was in the know, it can be likened to a declaration of war. And he urges, you know, Moscow and Berlin to use diplomatic channels to diffuse tension over this information about aggressive intentions. The former Brazilian naval officer also drew attention to German, this is key here, this is sort of understated, German authorities keeping mum on the matter. What that means is that the part of the audio discussion, that, so the German officials are openly talking about they're plotting to How do we destroy the Crimean Bridge? Despite saying for years we're just neutral in this, we're just supplying aid, they're actively planning to destroy a bridge. They also discuss how to hide what they're doing from the German government officials, the official channels, and from the public. Right. That's what they mean by keeping mum there. So let's cut back to this. We see NATO countries, which previously argued that they were not directly involved in the conflict and only limited themselves to sending key aid, have found themselves in hot water. That's the bottom line, is that the ruse is off. It's open now.
There's, you know, I'm feeling and seeing this wherever I go, both on the ground and in the sort of in the internet media. And I told you Kennedy did this interview it was a week or two ago, and he referred to the U.S. blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. And the host said, well, you don't really know that. And Kennedy's attitude was he just completely blew him off because he was trying to make a point and he didn't have time to play Mickey Mouse over Nord Stream.
Yeah.
And it was very presidential the way he did it. It was like, I have a country to run. I don't have time for that Mickey Mouse stuff. We're just talking about what we're going to do about this, this, and this, and what we need to do in the Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, he would have stopped and tried to defend his position. And now he didn't. He just said, look, you know, the whole attitude is we don't have time for those games anymore. You know, we need to deal with reality here. I'm not even going to be bothered with that. And, you know, I see it everywhere. People are moving to deal with reality, and they just don't have time for these Mickey Mouse games. And, of course, it's all coming out.
Right. The reality is there was 2 years of recordings of U.S. officials on both sides of the political aisle talking about stopping Nord Stream. That was leading up to the destruction of Nord Stream. And then immediately afterwards, you had a tweet from Victoria Nuland herself saying it's done.
Right.
Within like 15 seconds of it's blown off. Right. We know who did it. The U.S. did
it. Right.
Let's stop playing games. Take your Newsweek comic book to the corner and be quiet.
Right. But come back to the Germans. You have a layer of the German military and NATO infrastructure helping engineer the Ukraine war. But then you have a layer of diplomats with plausible deniability. And that's how the game is played. And
that raises an interesting point, because if you heard the officials, they're talking about keeping it secret, keeping the public in the dark, keeping the parliament in the dark. Now Germany officially has one of two choices. Either you prosecute those people for treason because they're inciting a war against an enemy, right? They're trying to provoke a war where your official position is, well, we're just supplying aid. So that's a real risk to German nation. So either prosecute for treason or come out and just do what you should have done all along, which is openly declare a war on Russia. What's it going to be, Germany? Man up.
I think what you do is you punish them for leaking and, you know, do the German equivalent of detailing them to the Anchorage office, because you cannot punish them. The whole chain of command breaks down. You know, it's like the financial crisis. You cannot prosecute them because then the whole chain of command breaks down. They did what they were told.
They were doing their job. You can't prosecute people.
Right, for doing their job. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's the same problem as U.S. banks committing crimes. No
so
one's prosecuted because they were doing their job.
You know, I was in a European capital to be unnamed when the Ukraine war started and sat down with some very big investors. And I said, why is Germany going along with this? Because, you know, I knew it would be deindustrialized and the U.S. would essentially make itself stronger by cannibalizing the Euro channel. And he said, Germany really believes they're going to get the Ukraine. It's like, really? Really?
Wow. Some serious delusion. I want to know the name and number of their drug dealer. That's some powerful stuff.
I think they're in Washington.
Wow. Yeah.
This
is dope. The central command for dope dealers. Okay, let's keep it going in Ukraine. Another big blow here. Russia says there are more than 12 CIA spy bases in Ukraine. So what's going on here is there were media reports claiming the CIA has built 12 secret spy bases along the Russian border in the Ukraine that act as a nerve center of Kiev's military. Quote, there are for sure not 12 CIA bases, but many more. It's not a secret, and we all know it perfectly well. We are the enemy of the CIA, says Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson. So the stories in the media broke from the U.S. that there were assets in the Ukraine, including 12 CIA spy bases, including, of course, legally is an open-ended term, meaning at least 12 spy bases. And Russia says, yeah, we see through that. There's more than 12. And everybody knows it.
So here is the question, because there was a lot of speculation. So the New York Times runs the story. And the New York Times, in my experience, is basically the official organ of the CIA, you know, because the CIA gave Amazon a contract. Amazon, you know, then became the cloud for the 17 intelligence agencies led by the CIA. And then that drives, is really the first time Amazon had profits. It drives the stock way up, and Bezos just happens to take a couple hundred million and buy the Washington Post. So the question is, does Bezos own the Washington Post, or does the CIA own the Washington? I would argue it's probably the CIA. But, you know, the New York Times, you know, has played that official organ as well. So why is this story coming out in the New York Times? Who wanted the story? Who gave them the information? Who corroborated the information? You know, there's no way the New York Times is bucking the CIA.
Right.
It's just, I can't fathom that could happen. So the question is, what's the goal of this story?
Is the goal to increase the scope of the war in Ukraine and expand it beyond the borders of Ukraine?
So, yeah, well, if it's going to go from a CIA to a NATO war, it's got to go from the intelligence agencies to the military. That's one. But, you know, I'm just speculating totally here. The other question is, if you look at the factions involved, traditionally you had the guys who ran the financial system who, in my opinion, in basically 95, 98 said, okay, neocons, you know, go have your day and make us a lot of money, and have let them, you know, run havoc all over the world. Are they stepping back in and taking control? Because they're more powerful, ultimately, the CIA, than the neocons. So do we have those guys coming back in? I don't know.
That's a real good question. And hold that thought until our next story, which is on the New York Times story. But it's a bit of a different angle. Remember, for 2 years, we've been hearing, every time you hear the war in Ukraine, it's the unprovoked Russian aggression. Unprovoked, unprovoked, unprovoked. Well, guess what? Turns out, not unprovoked. New York Times report demolishes the narrative of unprovoked war in Ukraine.
Right.
New York Times published a lengthy article revealing that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was instigated by a systematic and widespread campaign of military intelligence aggression on the part of the U.S. The Times writes, at the end of 2021, Putin was weighing whether to launch his full-scale invasion when he met with the head of one of Russia's main spy services, who told him that the CIA, together with MI6 in Britain, were controlling Ukraine and turning it into a beachhead for operations against Moscow. And after 2016, Ukrainians became impatient with what they consider Washington's undue caution. Ukraine wanted to do more against Russia, and they began staging assassinations and other lethal operations, which violated the terms of the White House, that the White House thought the Ukrainians had agreed to. Infuriated, officials in Washington threatened to cut off support, but here's the big deal, they never did. So you knew they were staging assassinations, and you went ahead with them anyway, U.S. Not a good look.
So there's only one reason the finance guys would rein in the neocons. And that is, you know, so the neocons, I think, since 1998 have been helping them get away with a lot and make a lot of money and basically engineer the financial coup. And for some reason, you know, the rope is over. They've cut the leash because it's not making the money. It's not working for them. And I would point out that Russia, through the G20, has embraced the BIS digital ID CBDC model. You know,
yep,
the only debate
sure
is
have.
Who's going to be right. Who's going to be the middle management? So, you know, the finance guys, basically, they are in the finance guys framework. And so for some reason, the finance guys have, you know, have shut down their pit bull here. I mean, the first thing, if you said to me, if the finance guys are taking back over, what would be the first thing that had happened? I'd say Newland's out. So that doesn't make it so, but I'm just saying. you know, this is what I'm going to be watching for. If
that's that's interesting,
right?
In other words, you take the queen off the chessboard and reassert control,
right?
Like, yeah, here's your queen. What do you got now?
Well, they'll strip out others. It's just Newland.
Yeah, but I think you're right. That's a very strong symbolic statement.
Right. Right. So that's what I'm going to be watching is have the central banker said, okay, neocons back in the box.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Let's turn to Fed Watch. You got to say this story of the week. We called it here on Money Markets, the reversal of the Colorado Supreme Court decision banning Trump from the ballot. It was a 9-0 decision by the Supreme Court. But let's run a clip. So we know that happened. Trump's on the ballot. Colorado can't just tilt an election like that. Saw it coming a mile away. We heard how bad the arguments on behalf of Colorado were in front of the Supreme Court. They were embarrassing. They were so bad. But what we want to do now is run a clip of all the predictions you heard from the TV on what a lot airtight case Colorado had. And listen to the confidence and listen to the talking points by these media talking heads. This is unbelievable. Talking about how Trump's an insurrectionist.
We begin tonight with the consequences of insurrection.
Donald Trump is ineligible to serve as president under the Constitution's insurrection clause.
Because he is disqualified, it would be a wrongful act under the election code for the Colorado Secretary of State to list him as a candidate on the presidential primary ballot.
Colorado is executing its state's rights to decide who should be on their own ballot.
Oh, I'm very proud to be a Coloradan and an American today.
This was a real process. It was consideration of a great deal of evidence.
It's grounded in the Constitution.
That language in the Constitution, Jim, simply could not be any clearer.
This is a slam dunk.
The former president is not eligible to be president again.
Trump incited and therefore engaged in an armed insurrection against the Constitution.
Trump is indeed ineligible to be president.
Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection against the Constitution.
The former president should not be allowed to run again.
And in fact, the former president is disqualified.
Donald Trump cannot be president.
For under the Constitution, he cannot be our president again.
And engaging in insurrection has disqualified himself from holding any future federal office.
Will the Supreme Court agree with themselves?
We're confident the Supreme Court will reject that claim.
All right, we just got the breaking news. The Supreme Court issuing a ruling on the Colorado ballot case.
The court has made a decision.
This is a win for former President Trump. Here, the Supreme Court has reversed a ruling from the Colorado Supreme Court.
We've learned that it was a 9-0 decision.
9-0. Wow, I guess they weren't, that confidence was misplaced. He has engaged in insurrection against the Constitution.
So the case was a joke. I mean, it's shocking to me that it even got to the Supreme Court. And given the weakness of the case, you really wonder what just happened. Was this really a sincere effort on the part of Colorado? Or, you know, are we talking about people who are just wildly stupid and incompetent, or... You know, somebody's strategic sense here is pretty rotten because they did a great job of helping Trump.
I'll push back on that. I'll tell you, from my point of view,
right,
the strategy here isn't this particular case or that particular case. The strategy here is lawfare, which is a million lawsuits and a million different cases and a million different efforts. It's a flechette blast. It's like a flechette gun where nails go out in a million directions and you want one to hit.
Right.
And this one is the one that slipped through and got to the Supreme Court.
So he has almost 100 indictments against him.
Right.
And from what I see, it's all just making it stronger, him stronger in his base. So
it sure looks that way.
Right.
Because it makes you look like you'll grasp at straws. You'll sit there and call a totally meritless case.
Right.
You're like, oh, it's a slam dunk. You heard that guy say it's a slam dunk. Well, it's not a slam dunk. In fact, it was a steal and a coast-to-coast reverse slam dunk at the other end of the court. That's how wrong you were.
It reminds me, I told you, of my attorney on the last day of the first day of the last trial saying, oh, my God, it was a bluff the whole time. I was like, I've been telling you for 7 years it was a bluff, and I had to, you know, I refused to settle. I made them go to trial just so I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt it was a bluff, because no one could believe the bluff was that big, that bad, that ridiculous, whatever, but... You know, and that's what they do.
It's the up is down, left is right, gaslighting.
Right.
Effort you see again and again and again, and it's not working against it didn't work in the Supreme Court. It got crushed.
Right. So here's the challenge. If you're the president of the United States and the Department of Justice comes in and tells you something, you have to hire an independent firm to check all the evidence and make sure, you know, because their word is worthless.
Yeah. It's,
you know, how are they going to function?
Right. You can't trust you anymore. You lie about anything. Just lie through your teeth.
Right.
About everything.
Right.
Anyway, let's keep it going and let's get into the land grab part, the theme.
This is bad.
You know, life in the land grab. Here we go. This is the first of several.
Right.
Ag census. This is from the Idaho Farm Bureau Federation. Ag census shows Idaho lost 2,100 farms. This is interesting, the numbers. Lost 2,119 farms, or 8.5% of its total farms in the five-year period between 2017 and 2022. Okay? The data show there was 1.9 million farms and ranches in the U.S. in 2022. That was a 7% decline, or 142,000 fewer farms than during 17. So the declines here are consistent. You right. had an 8.5% decline in farms in Idaho, and nationwide it was 7%. Okay. Here's where it gets kind of interesting. That is the decline represents a 1.2% or 144 acre drop from the 11.7 million acres of total farmland in the state in 2017. So in other words, you lose 8.5% of farms, but you only lose 1.2% of land. That tells me
consolidation,
that what's being lost here is smaller farms.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And if you look at the, you have a lot of farmers aging and they don't have people in the family who want to take over the farm and continue. So, yeah. And a lot of these farms, if they're going to survive, have to convert to regenerative farms that are doing direct marketing. That's a huge change in model. So the five subsidy, you know, five big ag subsidy crops, you know, if you have nobody who's going to take it over, you're going to sell. And, you know, if you look at it, the home builders are coming and they will pay a lot for your land. So yeah. If you look at that 1.2%, my guess is a lot of that is going, you have consolidation into the bigger farms, but then you have land going for home building.
Oh, yeah, right. You have, in other words, the financial companies like BlackRock are coming in.
Right.
And Larry Fink isn't planting, you know, orchards. He's not herding sheep out there. Right. It's the land. Right. They're locking it up.
Right.
Okay.
They're locking it up in the Ukraine and they're locking it up in Iowa. It's one global lockup.
Well, they're not doing a good job. Ukraine, they're losing territory.
You don't know what deal that Fink has with the Russians.
I do not, but Russians are advancing westward. I know that much. They're past Avdiivka now. They're seemingly without restraint. But let's keep it going with life in the land grab in the U.S. and turn to the Texas wildfires. I want to play a couple of videos. They're kind of different in the way they present this. The first video I want to show is local news. Just the intensity of the fire is what blew me away in this. Let's take a look at this.
Tonight's top story, no end in sight in the largest fire in Texas history.
Here are three top headlines tonight. At least two people have died, and this raging inferno is creating a path of destruction the size of Rhode Island. The Smokehouse Creek fire has now torched more than 1 million acres.
As of tonight, the fire is only 3% contained. On the front lines are firefighters from the San Antonio area.
Tonight, our Alicia Niavis is getting new insight from a local crew there on the ground. Alicia?
While most firefighters are working to contain the flames in the panhandle, one local assistant fire chief has a different role. He's part of a medic team helping the firefighters stay out of harm's way.
Let's pull out. We got too many spots.
A battle against fire and ice.
Quite a bit of snow and sleet was really kind of what our main visual was today.
Firefighters made little headway corralling the fast-moving wildfire until today, when snow, rain, and 40-degree temperatures opened a window for progress.
Tuesday, two Bernie firefighters deployed to the panhandle.
I got here to Amarillo a little around 7:30 this morning.
24 hours later, stationed 30 miles away.
We're kind of on the outer edges.
Came their assistant fire chief, Walter Ball.
I'm part of the Emergency Medical Task Force.
Just west of Pampa, Texas, he's leading a team focused on taking care of firefighters.
Okay. That's an interesting piece. I mean, a few things are one, over 1 million acres. It's only 3% contained. It would have been a lot worse than 1 million, but for the snow and the sleet that shows up on time.
Right. And they reported two deaths. My reports, and it could just be because of the counties of people I'm talking to, is no deaths. Or maybe it's no death among the ranchers or the firefighters. So I don't know what those deaths were. But it's striking because the reports I'm getting are, you know, the federal government and the state government were late to the show, and it was really the ranchers who had organized and fought the fires in 2017 who are doing it again. And I get reports of extraordinary cooperation and teamwork, both in the panhandle, but then people, ranchers and other people from all over the country sending hay, sending, you know, feed for the cattle and doing everything they can to help. So if you look at the, you know, I said to you, the good news is we're on our own. The bad news is we're on our own. It's an extraordinary demonstration of sort of citizen cooperation. So
yeah, I tell you what, the ranchers are stepping up to the plate and solving the problem and at least mitigating the damage. I find that very credible, given our next clip. You know, which focuses on the ranchers.
Right. It's the ranchers and the local guys. It's local enforcement, local fire. You know, you have a lot of volunteer fire also in these kind of rural areas. So, you know, I would say that everyone in the panhandle understands that the federal government and the big state government is there to help the land grabbers, not them.
You know, that raises a kind of a minor point, that what you just said about the panhandle. When I kept hearing panhandle, I thought, okay, well, it's on the Gulf. You saw from that last clip at the very end with that map, the organization effort is way up north in
right.
Texas. And it makes sense. It's like, well, that's where snow and sleet would be.
Right.
Not in Houston.
Right.
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 Anyway, let's turn to the ranchers and turn to the dead animals. This next clip shows both of these. But I got to tell you, the mental toughness of these ranchers is just, you could see it on their faces.
They are extraordinary people.
Amazing. Okay, let's get this rolling. You see the dead animals in the background.
There's people cut fences, open gates, so the cows can move on their own, get out of the way of it. But it came so hard, so fast. Most of them weren't able to get away from it. Just by what I hear from the customers that we have, if you multiply that times 200 or 300 ranchers in the area, it's got to be in the thousands, and I don't know if that's 5,000, 10,000. It's really hard to say right now, but it's going to be pretty dramatic.
Right here on this ranch, there's about three ranches right here we lease, and we have about a little over 1,000 cows here. As you can see behind us, we're picking up beds today, and we're going out right now. Like this pasture we're standing in, there was 93 cows in it, and there's six left. So by the time it's all said and done, we're going to have lost probably 200 to 250 head, and that's just cows. We're right in the middle of calving season. In a few weeks, we'll really know what we've lost. I've spent the last 15 years building this cow herd up, and you can lose it overnight. But we've been very blessed and very fortunate that we've only going to lose 200, you know.
Wow.
They got donations coming in from California. You know, from all over the country. It's pretty wonderful. But it's a citizen effort. So
it is. I love that clip though by AP. I like that style of journalism where you just let the witnesses tell the story
right.
and let the camera pan around and just show you the scene.
Right.
And it's just like, wow, that's just a stunning thing. I mean, all the dead animals. and the right. cool of those ranchers to suffer a loss like that and to sit there and just sort of
they are the tough. They are great people. They're some of my favorite. I love the ranchers in the Panhandle, the ones I've met. No, they're just such fine people. I would point out that, you know, the county's up there, and that's where Boone Pickens had his farm. I mean, had his ranch. They had the highest percent for Trump in 2016 of any county. So we're talking about serious Trump country or serious, you know, very, these are deeply conservative people. They really believe yes. in property rights and the Second Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, to me, and I go back to the what we saw in Iowa, you have a high average age of a lot of ranchers and farmers. And so we just saw a young guy who's likely to build his herd back. But if you're, you know, if you're 65 or 70, you're not inclined to do a 15-year build back.
No.
And so right. if you look at the reports of how many, you know, he said this is calving season. You know, a lot of people are just going to sell out the herds because it, without the grass, it's too expensive to keep them alive. So they're going to, yeah. you know, so they're not going to build back their herds if they're older, and they're going to sell off their herds. And down the line, this means, you know, tremendous pressure on beef prices because you're talking about a big cattle operation that's a big part of the U.S. cattle operation and big feedlots yeah. up there, too. So, you know, I think I don't know how this ripples through the price of beef and control of the food supply, but it's not good.
Yeah, it's not good. I did the last thing I'll say about that young guy who said, you know, it's 15 years of my life, basically almost down the toilet. And then he turns right around and he says, you know, I'm fortunate. The humility right. of that guy, the mental toughness and the humility. That's what the feds, that's what these criminals in charge are up against, and that's why they're going to lose.
Right.
You're not going to beat a guy like that.
Right. You have very, that is the community with very powerful faith.
Yeah.
And faith and hard work. And, you know, I love it. You see it in the oil patch in Texas, too. You're up, you're down, you're up, you're down. You know, they live with wild swings in both ranching and in the oil and gas business because you can, you know, you can be a billionaire and then wiped out the next day. So they're used to managing that kind of risk, and they have the people who do it have extraordinary faith.
Yeah, and there wasn't even a flicker of anger throughout that entire clip among any of those people.
Well, anger will kill you. Anger, if you go through something like this and your response is anger, it will kill you. So you yeah. can't, they know.
Let's turn to a chart, though, of Xcel Energy. Want to do that?
Yep.
Okay. Let's yep. take a look at this chart. This is
so here's the electricity provider.
Who is Xcel Energy? Okay.
Xcel Energy is an energy conglomerate, and their one of their subsidiaries provides the energy, the electricity on the Panhandle, and it's widely believed that a power line going over sort of triggered the fire, and so. Yeah. If you look, and we've had some of the ranchers in the Panhandle or some of the people on the Panhandle, you know, speaking openly about Xcel. So this is a chart of Xcel Energy versus the sort of ETF that is the industry indicator. And so IDU, and we're just looking at a 1 month chart, and we're seeing as the fire starts, what happens right. to the stock. So Xcel, you know, the industry average up 4% during the period, but Xcel right. down 17.66%. And my guess is if you look at, you know, the market's going to wait and see what the quality of the lawsuits are. So the lawsuits are starting to come in.
Well, this, okay, so it comes in, the Texas homeowner lawsuit filing comes in here. And the market said, right. oh, that's worth a 7% drop. Of the stock.
They're looking at the lawsuit, but I don't think the big lawsuits have come in yet. So, you know, so we'll see. It's going to depend on the quality of the legal assessment. But, you know, if Xcel really is responsible, you could see, I don't know if you bankrupt the subsidiary or the whole company, but you could see a pretty serious situation for Xcel. If you look at the ownership, it's broad institutional ownership with Vanguard, BlackRock, yeah. State Street, and J.P. Morgan Chase.
They're the owners. But look at these numbers, though, Catherine. Aren't these are a little 14%. Vanguard shows up on everybody's proxy statement as one of the leading investors, but 14%, that's a big number. So is 10%.
Right. So I'm very curious to see if Xcel's really on the ropes, who comes in and takes over? Because if you look at their electrical lines and what they supply, you know, this is an important piece for the control grid. So, so I'm going, you know, if Buffett suddenly sails in and takes over, I'm going to be very suspicious. Anyway, so it's going to be interesting to watch what happens to their stock.
Yeah, it will be. But that is an interesting chart, and that is an interesting. Typical numbers on institutional ownership are Vanguard 8, you know, BlackRock 7.
Vanguard's high. Yeah.
But they're hardly ever do I see them over 10%. I mean, it's kind of rare. 14%, right. I don't ever recall seeing that high. But I don't know how big this company is. Presumably it's pretty big, though.
It's big, and the, you know, it may be some of the energy mutual funds that have a big position that could explain it. But I didn't dig in and take a look at Vanguard's position, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's I would say this. I would just ask that you pray for the ranchers on the Panhandle, because what they've been through is extraordinary, and the way they've handled it is extraordinary. It's a real demonstration of the greatest qualities of America.
It is. It truly is.
Oh, and we'll get to it later. We put up a link for wildfire relief if you want to help. We'll go through the link later. Sorry, okay. Go ahead.
Let's turn to the worst of America, and starting with the Treasury Secretary, who is urging world leaders to unlock frozen Russian central bank assets and send them to Ukraine. So it's just they're frozen. They've been frozen for, 2 years? And now it's just like, well, let's just take them. Let's just take them.
We want them. Let's just take them.
Look at the reasoning here, okay? Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is offering her strongest public support yet for the idea of liquidating, stealing roughly $300 billion in frozen Russian central bank assets and using them for Ukraine's long-term reconstruction. These assets, by the way, I believe are in Denmark. They're for certain in Europe. She says, quote, "It is necessary and urgent for our coalition to find a way to unlock the value of these immobilized assets to support Ukraine. I believe there is a strong international law, economic, and moral case for moving forward. This would be a decisive response to Russia's unprecedented threat to global stability," she said. So look at this. It's necessary and urgent, and that's enough, okay? It's urgent, so go ahead and do it. Don't worry about it. I believe there is a strong case. Not that there is. I think there's one. So take the money first, and we'll worry about the lipstick on the pig with our lawyers later. Unbelievable.
Congress isn't dishing up as much money as they want or need.
Yeah.
That's what it says.
So I yell, and I'm going to step up to the plate, and I'm going to do it myself. So just the woman openly urinates with all the world watching in Brazil on the rule of law.
Right.
And says, well, I'm here to save the day.
So we have story after story of country talking about pulling their gold out of the U.S. because they don't want their assets frozen.
Yeah, these assets are in Europe, and she's saying, I'm going to reach over.
Right. So, but I guess what I'm saying is, you know, the power of the dollar system is everybody playing in it. If you make it worth their while for everybody to move out, guess what? I mean, every day I'm writing and talking. So we just published an interview, a great interview with Richard Werner on why every state needs a banking depository dedicated to that state that's not controlled by New York or Washington. Now, why are they doing that? You know, that's basically a shift out of the main dollar system because they can't trust it. It's run by criminals. So yeah. If Washington is run as a criminal operation, if Yellen is running a criminal enterprise, then it's, you know, it's like the herd moving away from the diseased animal. It's the end of empire. So
Janet Yellen, she is a criminal. Look at the whole thing. She could have said this a year and a half ago when she thought things were going her way. And now that the war is not going our way, suddenly it's urgent. And we need to act now and just do it now. There's no legal reasoning there. There's no rule of law there. There's no statute. She doesn't talk about any kind of due process.
Right.
She doesn't talk about any kind of procedure for what we need to do. It's just take the money first and we'll make the legal case later. Unbelievable. What a thug.
We're not talking right now. We're talking about stealing money from Russia. But let's just talk about stealing money from U.S. pension funds, because U.S. pension funds are the biggest buyers of Treasury. OK, so every day, every week, every month, the Secretary of the Treasurer, as the authorizing official, sells bills and bonds into our pension funds. The money leaves our pension funds and it goes to Treasury, and then it disappears out the back door. At least it was disappearing out the back door till 2015, you know, and after that they created secret books. So now it's you know, who knows where it's going. And I would like to point out, we don't need to issue bonds to finance the government. Treasury can just issue greenbacks, right?
Right. They issue quarters and dimes, don't they?
Right. And so the reason they're not issuing greenbacks is basically they're running an operation to steal from our pension funds, right?
Right.
There you go. It's, yeah. You know, so if you think they're stealing from the Russians, it's because they've, you know, they're stealing everything from American pension funds and they've run out of, you know, they need more, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think this is just the Russians. This is us.
Well, think about it this way. I mean, if Janet Yellen can say, well, let's just steal assets from Russia in Europe, what's to prevent her from saying, you know what, it's necessary and urgent to freeze your bank account and delete your bank account here in the U.S.? It's necessary and urgent. I believe there's a legal case for it. We're just going to delete your account. What's to stop her from doing that? Nothing.
So if you're a reporter who worms your way into a press conference with Janet Yellen, I want you to ask her how many passports she has. I want you
we'll
to ask
her, in a
is she a citizen of any other country other than the United States?
I'd love for somebody to do that.
Right.
And we'll
right.
we'll get to the passport issue soon. But right now, let's turn to space military and global turf wars. I didn't realize how big 2024 is in terms of kind of the turnover in leadership across the world. But get a look at this. This is from Visual Capitalist, the map of 2024 global elections by country. And you can see here's kind of the map, and it's pretty crowded. But the more interesting graphic for my money is this: top 20 most populous countries holding national elections. And you can see down here, India, number one, United States, Indonesia. I mean, this is almost like half of the globe.
Yeah.
These countries here.
I think the population number was 60 or 70% of the world population. It's about 4 billion people
incredible.
Are having elections. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Just a massive turnover going on around the world.
Yep. Yep.
Interesting time. So to me, the upshot of that graphic is that multiplies the number of possible outcomes. I mean, given all the different controversies and all the wars across the world going on right now, there's a lot of different ways the dice can turn up.
And that's why, you know, when we talked in the annual wrap about the pushback and 2024 being Operation Pushback, if you get this surge of pushback that we're experiencing combined with all those elections, it's a transformative situation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's potentially very, very transformative. I mean, in other words, a year from now, it may be entirely different.
Right. So my message to everybody is get off the couch and any time, you know, whatever your impulse is to push back, push back. Because everybody pushing back can make an enormous difference. There is a tipping point, and we have a tremendous advantage if we will all just do what we can to push.
Yep. Right. Yep. Very, very well put. Okay. Let's turn to another story. This next story is good for the facts it brings. The conclusion, you know, it's predictable and wrong. Let's look at it. This is from thehill.com, but I've got it up in Wayback Machine. Assassination attempts are on the rise worldwide. Is the U.S. next? Interesting question. So what's going on? And this is where the facts are interesting. In South Korea, so-and-so was stabbed in the neck on June. Who was that? Somebody in South Korea was stabbed in the neck. A leader was stabbed in the neck. Okay. In August 2023, Ecuadorian presidential candidate Fernando Villavicencio was assassinated by Colombian hitmen. They keep going on. And the U.S. is not above the fray here. Speaker of the House Pelosi and conservative Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh were the targets of plots. And so they list all these different and you had also Argentinian Vice President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, okay, an attempt to assassinate. And then we covered this here on Money and Markets. Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was killed by a lone gunman. I mean, this is a lot of assassinations and attempted assassinations up to and including the U.S. And this is where it gets predictable. They blame all of this in the United States, to be sure. The norms of civility have frayed, driven in no small part by, you knew it was coming, former president who seems to delight in threatening violence against his political opponents. Okay, that part, take it or leave it. The number of assassinations, though, and assassination attempts is what's interesting.
Right, right. And I would expect that, actually, if you look at the assassination attempts in the United States, it's much higher than people know. One, because a lot is done with poisoning or things that are, you know, they go in for elective surgery and something goes wrong and they die. It doesn't look like an assassin. So you have many ways of assassinating people without it looking like assassination. But if you look at our history, I mean, I was politically active in the 60s, and we know we had two Kennedys, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King. It's not like we haven't had assassinations here. But there is no doubt that the tensions are greater. And as you know, I think our most hopeful scenario is the establishment starts killing each other. So I call it the Midianite thing. The Midianite thing is upon us. It is upon us. And Newland leaving means there's a big shift coming, and we're watching leadership changing over. You know, I won't go into what's been happening in the royal family, big question mark, but you're seeing all sorts of leadership turning over and fraying. And I think, you know, whatever is happening with Operation Pushback, the money is running thin.
I think that's exactly right. I think the money is running thin.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. Anyway, the assassinations, that's a great point. Newland, that's a signal that a big shift is underway, especially when coupled with all these different elections.
Yeah, Newland left because she didn't want to get assassinated.
Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? I don't know, but you know, she's essentially the de facto president of the Ukraine.
Right. Was
let's call it the shadow president of the Ukraine.
Right.
Not anymore. Boy, big changes coming. Okay, let's shift focus to Hey Robot. We have one story on AI and one story on crypto this week. They're both pretty interesting. AI is courtesy of Taibbi, who raises an interesting question in Racket News. If AI thinks George Washington is a black woman, why are we letting it pick bomb targets? And he points out the U.S. used artificial intelligence to identify targets hit by airstrikes in the Middle East this month, a defense official said. And he says, you know, and this is part of a growing trend of military use of technology for combat. And yet we do see things like AI saying, oh, yeah, George Washington is a black woman. Like, I guess the question is, what's the ultimate purpose? What's the high level purpose behind AI?
The high level purpose of allowing AI to choose bomb targets is that no officer is responsible for what happens or the decision.
That's how I read it too.
That's legal trickery. Legal trickery. So a military can break international law all day long, and it wasn't. I didn't do it. It was the AI, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's just another version of, well, the computer did it. The computer said, right? The computer made
mommy,
me do
mommy.
It.
Mommy, the aliens made me do it.
Computers are smart. They told me to bomb that family.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's incredible. I think that's exactly right.
So, I just did what the computer picked. I don't, right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's turn to Bitcoin. This next story is, to me, super interesting. Let me just get to it. This is from Fidelity. It's the best source I could find on it. U.S. Energy Data Agency to temporarily suspend Bitcoin miner survey. They're suspending a survey after a lawsuit. So what's going on here? Department of Energy on Friday agreed to temporarily suspend its emergency survey of energy use by cryptocurrency miners following a lawsuit by Bitcoin miner Riot Platforms, okay, and an industry group. Riot Platforms and the Texas Blockchain Council had sued the Biden administration in court on Thursday seeking to block the survey, which they said could harm businesses by forcing them to divulge confidential and sensitive information. Okay, I'd be interested in learning about that, but I'm not going to learn about it. Instead, we hear the plaintiffs claimed in their lawsuit that Bitcoin mines, which use large amounts of electricity for computing and cooling data processing centers, this is according to the plaintiffs, the Bitcoiners, that the Bitcoin mines can actually improve reliability since they can be quickly shut down to offset spikes in energy demand during severe weather that can cause blackouts. Okay, so thank you for gaslighting me like that. Now I know who's behind you.
Right.
All that energy consumption is a good thing because it enables us to shut things down quickly. Are you kidding me? Pull the other one.
Yeah, well, you know, what can I say? It was a couple years ago, Bitcoin was using more energy than Switzerland or Germany. So I always bring this up when they start with the climate change stuff. Really? Have you looked at what the control grid costs? The control grid is so energy, you know, the energy consumption is beyond imagination. So it's one of the great fallacies of, you know, we need to pretend climate change so we can suck up all the energy for the control grid.
Yeah. But that is suspending the survey. That's ridiculous.
Well, if you look at, Carolyn just did a great interview with John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute on the census. They're putting out census as the most invasive things I have ever seen in my life. It's unbelievable. I mean, the next thing they're going to have you do is count the molecules in your body and report that. It's just unbelievable. And so the idea that the government anytime we can say we're allowed to have confidential information, that's great. But I don't see this. I don't see their argument. Anyway,
what's confidential? The reading on your meter? How? Pray tell how? And anyway, they don't even address that. They're just like, no, don't worry about it. You know, huge energy bills are good because you can switch it on and off. And what a bunch of hand waving nonsense.
Right.
Speak that I may see thee. Thank you. Right. Okay. Let's turn to Farmageddon. This is a tweet from a woman whose work I greatly respect. Her name is Jessica Hockett, and she focuses a lot on how the death numbers were jimmied up
right.
in the U.S. at the very front end of the pandemic to sell the public on the notion that there was this big, terrifying pandemic to begin with. And she right. says, you know what? A lot of people were murdered to jimmy those numbers up. And here, this post on this tweet, she gets into it a little bit. Let me show you how easy it was to create the appearance of an emergency in the U.S. with only some cities and metro areas. I'm using all-cause deaths. That's what she's all-cause mortality. She says, remember when the New York Times published the names of 100,000 U.S. COVID deaths on May 24th, 2020? And that was a big part of the sell. That was a big part of this terrifying event.
Right.
She says, here's how you do it. Okay, here are the cities you need to sell the public on this. You need New York, Chicago, L.A., Philly, and Boston. Okay, you don't need D.C., Minneapolis, Dallas, or Seattle. She says, here you go. Here's the chart of if you look at deaths, all-cause mortality deaths between 2019 and 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going May to May. This should say here, this should say May, both of those columns. Anyway, she says, here are the numbers. Look, New York's Kings County, plus 8,279, okay? Now, I personally went through and tabulated, like, the top 10 here, okay? The top 10 of these counties, if you add them up,
right.
comes to 49,856. So you got half of the deaths just from, like, the top 10 counties there.
Right.
Wow. That's right. How they sold this as a pandemic. They killed people. With protocols.
And Cuomo was instrumental in doing this. That's why they had to boot him out.
Yeah. Like it was New York and L.A., a little bit of Massachusetts. And,
right.
But don't forget good old Cook County here. Taking one for the team. Yep.
Yep, always.
But anyway, Jessica Hockett does really, really good work. Right. And she's like a dog on a bone with this. She will not let this go. And you need people like that.
Interestingly enough, if you look at those locations and the rigging of the 2000 election, I think you're going to see a lot of similarities as well, because it was just a few metro. It was basically six metro areas that pulled the whole thing off.
Yeah, the notable exception would be Milwaukee.
Right.
Not in there.
Right.
But Milwaukee, you know, in some greater metropolitan surveys, Milwaukee is considered to be like greater metropolitan area. Milwaukee is considered to be like a burb of Chicago.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Chicagoland area, I think, when they say it's 10 million people, includes Milwaukee, if memory serves. Anyway. Right. But let's keep it going to Farmageddon with a reminder that, you know, it's not just the U.S. and it's not just the West. This is from the Moscow Times from 2021. Russia seeks funding for Putin's genetic database. Putin has sought to transform Russia into a world leader in genetic technologies. In 2020, he ordered the creation of a national genetic information database. So Farmageddon's worldwide. It's not just West.
Right. I forget what I was reading this week where somebody said, you know, after the establishment realized they couldn't extract more subsidy by playing the, you know, with globalization, playing the third world extraction game, they decided their new target was the DNA of their own citizens.
Yeah. Is that right? Yeah, right.
Yeah, here right. we go.
Here we go. Yeah, it's the same thing in the U.S. They want the same thing. I mean, but Putin, if he hasn't changed his mind, and there's been some change.
To me, this is part of Russia being fully on board for the digital ID, the CBDC, or financial transaction control. And part of that is the human energy body. It's the DNA. So that's part of this control grid.
And, yep, part
and
of the
Russia,
control.
Russia, China, are full, India fully on board. And the notion that somehow the multipolar world is going to save us. No, we have to save ourselves.
You've got to save yourself. It's on you.
Right.
Russia and China, as a reminder, they've got a debt-based monetary system just like us. The countries that don't have debt-based monetary systems, they tend to have names like Somalia and Libya and countries that have been basically eliminated.
Right. Although Russia has very low per capita debt. Russia does have very low per capita debt.
The U.S. had low per capita debt for a long time, too, when it's a manufacturing economy. But the life cycle of a debt-based monetary system is, yeah, there's some heydays. And then once you get through the manufacturing cycle, you go into the casino cycle.
Right.
So it is written, so shall it be. China and Russia, your day is coming. It's just not here yet. But you're on your way. Anyway. Well,
I don't know. You know, you don't have to go. There are ways of growing the economy without debt.
Right.
It can be done. So that's.
Right.
Yeah.
But they issue money the same way we do. They borrow it.
Right. So.
Yep.
I don't know. I'm always holding out for advanced civilization. It can happen here.
Oh, okay. I'm holding out for the next segment of the show, which is pushback.
Okay, here we go.
We're getting more and more pushback. This next one is from a Belarusian TV station.
I love this. This is great.
They call out. So what they're talking about is the WHO sort of hinting around. There's a new disease. It's going to be big, bad, and scary. It's going to be worse than coronavirus. It's a disease X or whatever. These Belarusian TVs, and they're young, this crew, they're having none of it.
This is big because if you look at the team that's been trying to stop the WHO, you know, all the leaders are saying, we know it's terrible, but we're in a debt trap and we can't do this and we don't want to do it unless we're the, you know, other countries are coming out at the same time. You know, everybody's doing mealy mouth. And now Belarus has decided, what the hell, we're plugging, you know, we're shooting a hole in the dam. And this is the first. This is a huge global first. So Belarus leads the way. Here you go. Thank you, Belarus.
They do. Here you go. Be ready to read fast-moving closed captions. It's in a foreign language, but there's closed captions at the top. Anyway, let's take a look at this.
Всемирная организация здравоохранения активно готовится ко всепланетарному буйству болезни X. Вирус где-то незримо, но неумолимо зреет, намереваясь начать свою убийственную жатву. Единственный способ для человечества выжить – это, конечно, молиться, но не богам, а ВОЗ. «Приди же, Тедрос Гебрейесус, владей нами, ну спаси». Приблизительно такова логика авторов пресловутого пандемического соглашения, о котором, надо полагать, многие даже не слышали, а оно, между тем, обещает радикальнейшим образом переменить жизнь землян, причем всех и каждого. Слово Олегу Романову.
Удивительное дело, насколько быстро стерлось из людской памяти недавнее всепланетное административное безумие. Почти по всей Европе людей отправили под замок, а за простую прогулку по парку можно было схлопотать чудовищный штраф. В Британии, просто собравшись небольшой компанией на семейный рождественский ужин, скажем, вы рисковали расстаться с 20 тысячами фунтов. В Германии необходимо было либо раз в трое суток делать ПЦР-тест, либо вакцинироваться. Просто для того, чтобы летать самолетами, ездить в автобусе или пойти в ресторан. В Италии невакцинированным запрещено было выходить на работу. Нарушителям полагался штраф в несколько тысяч евро. В Австралии и Новой Зеландии невакцинированного запросто отправляли на принудительный карантин. Полицейские надевали наручники и вывозили в загородный концлагерь. Еще удивительнее всеобщая забывчивость чиновников. Любая попытка найти виновников ковидного террора разбивается о бесстрастный ответ. Вакцинация была добровольной, карантин не являлся принудительным. А Всемирная организация здравоохранения до сих пор настаивает, что человечество удалось спасти от сам...
Wow. Wow. So they're calling BS an old pandemic. And then they say, you know, don't pray to the gods for this new one. Pray to the WHO. Come Tedros. Come Tedros and own us, please.
Well, this is good because, you know, the way, you know, mocking is far more effective than anger.
Oh.
So these are smart, savvy young people who are saying, you know, are mocking. They're just like, you guys are, you know, and
yeah,
I don't know, you know, let's see who follows.
Comedy is an inherently subversive art.
Yes.
And I'll point out something Norm Macdonald, an American comic, said. It was very true about Trump. He says Trump basically, you know, not he didn't do it intentionally, but he kind of destroyed comedy because suddenly you had 10,000 comics whose only thing was an imitation of Trump or one-liners about Trump. He basically
right.
destroyed the entire – so – your most subversive art form is basically gone now. There are no comics left in the U.S. You got to go to Belarus to get good comedy, or Italy.
No.
Have you seen the Italian imitations
no.
of Biden? Oh
no,
oh
no. We do need more comedy. It's true. We do need
more
comedy.
We need a lot more. Yep. We do. Okay, let's keep it going and push back and go to the U.K. This is a good story. This is pushback is moving up the chain, to be sure. Health Secretary urged to release data that may link COVID vaccine to excess deaths. There's the Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins. Members of Parliament and peers have accused the Health Secretary of withholding data that could link the vaccine to excess deaths and criticized a wall of silence on the topic. A cross-party group has written to the Health Minister to sound alarm about growing public and professional concerns at the UK's rate of excess deaths since 2020. Ministers, health ministers, blame the excess on record NHS waiting lists, National Health Service waiting lists, and the pandemic backlog. But the parliamentarians are having none of it. They're demanding to be shown the underlying data that supposedly support the government's assertion that there is no evidence linking excess deaths to vaccines for COVID-19. Wow.
Andrew Bridgen is on a roll. Yeah.
Is that who's really behind this?
You have Bridgen and a couple other people now coming in, and they're on a roll. They're not backing down. So
that's great. That's great. Because to my way of thinking, if there's one country in the world that has more criminality than the U.S., it would be U.K.
Right.
Right. I mean, they kind of invented a lot of these things.
Right.
You know, we're still kind of a colony in a way, and yet here they are pushing back on vaccine deaths. Like these, that to me, I was kind of stunned about that story, that it's crept up to the level of Parliament.
Right. Well, Prigden reminds me of, you know, I talked about Kennedy with the Nord Stream, but you have these people who have now made a complete connection between productivity and getting rid of the law, you know, and they want to deal with reality, and they don't have time for the game or the lies anymore. It's not working. And they're ready to kind of leave the station and say, you know, it's like the people in Belarus, you know, let's talk about reality. Let's deal with reality. We're tired of the game. They won't respect the game anymore. They don't have time. And what you're seeing is the price of inflation. This pushback is coming not so much from the deaths of COVID and the disability. It's coming from that combined with inflation, because prices are going up, 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 and it's squeezing people's productivity, and they can't afford the game anymore.
Wow. You think that's, I don't know.
Yeah. The biggest pushback is from inflation. That and it's driving, if you look at what the folks in Belarus just said, it's driving these things. They don't have time. You can't afford, if inflation is going up 10 or 20% a year, you cannot afford to pay money to a criminal enterprise that uses that money to poison and kill you. Right?
Yeah. I think, to me, a likelier explanation than inflation, I mean, inflation's got a lot to do with it, to be sure. But to me, it's like the more time that goes on and the more people who drop like flies, the more times you're getting this explanation.
Yeah.
There's no explanation for what happened. Or you're getting explanations from official sources and from doctors that simply don't make sense, and people have had enough of it.
Right. Well, I have had many, many people in the last month tell me that friends that they tried to stop from taking the vaccination are finally coming back and saying, you were right. And that's new.
I've yet to see that in my own.
I've gotten 4, 5, 6 reports in the last 2 weeks.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. Very encouraging. Right.
Yeah, in Raleigh on Saturday night, some people kind of correctly refer to where I live, the county where I live. It's called Wake County, but it's known as Woke County. There's not a lot of come-to-Jesus moments in Woke County. And people realize, like, hey, maybe the vaccine killed that person. It's still more like, well, maybe it was sunspots that day. No, really. They'll believe any explanation.
I know.
However ludicrous, as long as it isn't Precious Pharma, can't
right.
do that.
Right.
Okay, let's keep it going and push back. This next story, kind of life in the land grab. Let's talk about how big this land grab is and how extensive it is. Farmers in March in Poland's capital. So we've seen, you know, farmers in the Netherlands, right, protesting, farmers in France protesting. This is farmers in March in Poland's capital, cut off roads in Spain to protest Ukraine imports and EU policies. Thousands of farmers marched in Poland's capital, so Warsaw, okay? And Spanish farmers cut off traffic on highways near the French border in Spain in latest protests against food imports from Ukraine and European Union's agricultural policies. The West is experiencing growing fatigue in helping Ukrainians as they try to push back Russia's invasion. That's remarkable. I mean, protests in Warsaw, farmers pushing back in Warsaw, all the way down to farmers in Spain.
Right.
That's a lot of geographic territory. That's 1,400 miles.
Right. My understanding is the U.S. pushed the Ukraine into GMOs. And for feed, GMOs are accepted in Europe, but not for much of the food. And I'm wondering what the quality issues are on that food. So, you know, because certainly it's doing two things. It's trying to undercut the market, but they're real. My guess is there are real quality issues there. There may be.
So I think it's fair to say now, given that story, that the protests are up in Poland. Farmer protests are up in Poland. I mean, farmer protests are all over Europe, literally.
All over Europe, everywhere. And what's interesting is the farmers in Europe are much more extroverted as a group. They're much more connected to the market as a group. You know, it's not five big ag subsidies, you know, that's very much on the federal dole, although they're definitely national subsidies. But they're very well educated. They're very attractive people. You know, they're people you want to know. They're people who are liked and trusted by their neighbors. So, we'll talk about it in a second, but the PDF now is out on Dutch farmers and fishermen.
Right.
And it's the best we've ever done. It is absolutely a magnificent document. You know, the whole team just came together and did an amazing job, but it will help you understand the European farmers and how they fit into the control grid. And the beauty of what's happened in Europe, and this gets back to the pushback, it took years for the farmers to realize, oh, this is simple. They're just trying to steal our stuff.
Yeah.
This is war. They're trying to control the food system. They're trying to steal our stuff. And they don't want people to have good, nutritious food to eat. And, you know, it took forever to break through the disbelief that it could be this nuts and this psychopathic. But now they've, you know, they've broken through and they're like, oh, now we get it. It's war. You're trying to steal. It's a taking. And we're not going to let you take. And so
the front on the war is big. I mean, Warsaw to southwest Spain, that's like Oklahoma. That's like New York City to Oklahoma City.
It's the entire food. It's the entire food system of Europe.
Yeah.
And the other thing the farmers and fishermen see is the U.S. is deindustrializing Germany and deindustrializing Europe, you know, and poaching the Euro Channel. And they see that essentially what is happening to them is part of being, you know, of losing not only national sovereignty in Europe, but European sovereignty. So
right.
They got right on their side, you know, five times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Okay, let's wrap it up in pushback with a piece. It's a TED Talk. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's about nonviolent resistance. And it's an interesting number this woman discusses. I'm not necessarily a fan of TED Talks. Kind of suspect. Right. I don't think you are either. But there's some interesting
concept. Good stuff sneaks through.
Yeah, let's just play a snippet here. Okay.
So why is civil resistance so much more effective than armed struggle? The answer seems to lie in people power itself. Researchers used to say that no government could survive if just 5% of its population rose up against it. Our data show that the number may be lower than that. No single campaigns failed during that time period after they'd achieved the active and sustained participation of just 3.5% of the population. And lots of them succeeded with far fewer than that. Now, 3.5% is nothing to sneeze at. In the US today, that's like 11 million people. But get this, every single campaign that surpassed that 3.5% was a nonviolent one. In fact, the nonviolent campaigns were on average four times larger than the average violent campaigns. And they were often much more inclusive and representative in terms of gender, age, race, political party, class, and the urban-rural distinction. Civil resistance allows people of all different levels of physical ability to participate. So this can include the elderly, people with disabilities, women, children, and anyone else who wants to.
Okay. You want to add the Fitz caveat to...
Yeah, so the Fitz caveat to this is she, if you look at her survey, she's included a lot of items since World War II, which I think were CIA engineered or intelligence agency soft revolutions, you know, where they're using entrainment, they're using surveillance, they're using dirty tricks. So, you know, so I'm more comfortable with the 5% number than the 3.5% number. But I think her fundamental theses are correct. And it's one of the reasons the intelligence agencies went to trying to engineer the soft revolutions instead of the violent revolutions, because they saw, you know, the fundamental truth of what she's saying. And what, you know, this happened in Raleigh because we kept saying to people, don't worry about the people in the trance, you know, worry about getting tools and resources and connecting up with the 3.5%. We don't need everybody. We need the 3.5% to find each other, to be effective in their strategies and tactics, and to provide resources and tools to that 3.5%. Stop worrying about the people in trance. You don't need everybody to have a highly effective civil disobedience revolution. So, I think Mary Holland from CHD, the president of CHD, sort of put me onto this. And I think it's a very important and encouraging thing. And, you know, another example, Mary Holland is always making fantastic contributions to everybody every week. So it's another great example of the kind of intelligence that you know, the CHD network always brings. But I think this has very important messages for everybody who want to understand strategies and tactics of effective pushback.
There's another point she makes, though, is really interesting. And I think you're totally right to focus on what I'll call Samuel Adams' irate, tireless minority. That's where the action is. Forget the people in the trance. Forget the zombies. Okay, don't let them get you down. But the other interesting thing to sort of harken back to the revolution is, you know, revolution is a young person's act. You know, to pull off a revolution, I'm sorry, but you got to be young. You can't do it once the bones set in so much.
Right.
But her point is, you know, with nonviolent resistance, everybody can play.
Everybody can play.
Young kids can play. Older people can play. It's game on.
Right.
And so if you can get to that 5%, that's where the action really is.
Right. I will say this because I've been looking at, you know, all the different generations and age groups who are pushing back, and you want as many young people as you can, and you want to push them forward in leadership. What is great is the old people who are retired. So if you look at my generation, a lot of these people are retired and they have a lot of knowledge and wisdom, and they can make the young people really, really smart. So,
yes.
And the other thing is they're fearless. They're not afraid of death. You see these people who have reached a certain point in their life and they're looking at the next generations and they're saying, I'm not letting this happen to my kids and grandkids. And they are, you know, so if you're 60 or older and you've lived a great life, hey, go for broke. You've got nothing to lose, right?
Right.
You're all going to die. But,
right.
But, you know, it's time for the older generation to lift up and make the young ones smart, but also to do the most dangerous, you know, freedom fighting, because we can afford to take those risks. So
yeah,
I just think there's a real role for and the generation that's got the hardest job is your generation, John, because, you know, you're having to provide for the family, you know, you're taking care of the kids, you're taking care of the grandparents, you're, you know, running the business, you're doing all that kind of stuff. And it's that generation that's responsible to manage the economic productivity of the family and take care of everybody up and down that's got the, you know, the time pressure and the shadow work and inflation. The clock eatery is eating your clock.
Yeah,
so it's that middle generation that's really under stress.
Yeah. I completely agree. But the point about everybody included in nonviolent resistance is very well taken.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, and that will wrap it up for pushback. Let's now move to charts, starting with the S&P versus VGK and FXI.
So we're starting with the vote for the going direct reset in August 2019. And, of course, S&P, all I can tell you is reset's working, right? S&P up 70%.
It's working for the S&P 500.
Right. So Larry Fink and Vanguard, they're doing great. Anyway, so the S&P up 70%. China really suffering from being in the debt trap. And, you know, they've exhausted their debt growth model and down 42%. And clearly the tensions, you know, have hit China hard. And, of course, we see the property bubble burst. And, of course, Europe way behind. So S&P up 70%, Europe up 22%. And again, Germany being deindustrialized. It's painful to watch.
It is. It is painful to watch. And it's also kind of painful to watch the going direct reset work. Be that as it may, let's keep going to the next chart here. What do we got? Oh, FinViz. Look at this. Normally, VIX, you know, for a long time has been down in the basement.
Yep.
Dude, it's taking the elevator, not to the penthouse, but it's getting close. Look at that.
Yeah. And you can feel it because, you know, gold and Bitcoin both moving up strongly. So Bitcoin to me is more a pump and dump. But you start to see these inflation numbers coming out, including the food.
Yeah. Big time. And the sugars again, cocoa at the top. That's kind of becoming a permanent resident up there.
Yep.
But let's move to the next one. The next chart is, come on, gold and silver.
Yeah. So this is since the going direct reset, and we see gold just suddenly, you know, moving up strongly. But since the nowhere near as strong as the S&P, but gold up 42%, silver up 36%. And of course, the long treasury still down in the basement. And, you know, the whole game that's holding up that S&P and the plunder economy is depending on the treasury market. And that's where the real tension in the system is. And that's why it's so interesting to see the fix, fixed roll-up, because what it says is there are questions about whether, you know, whether and how the Fed can keep that game going, particularly if you have the Secretary of Treasury saying we need to plunder the Russian assets.
Would you say, I'm going to scroll up to this. Would you say that the success of the going direct reset, as shown in the S&P 500, is coming at the expense of the long Treasury being down 1/3?
Yes. Absolutely.
That's what it looks like. That is absolutely right. What that looks like.
Right. And here's the thing. The thing that's keeping that game going is massive government subsidy, which is focused, you know, whether it's coming through the central bank or the Treasury, it's focused on some sectors and, it, you know, and building the, it's basically we are financing building the control grid with our pension funds.
Yeah.
And the world, the rest of the world is resigned and they've said, okay, you know, we're not going to buy those Treasuries. So you want to stick them to the pension funds, that's fine. You want to buy them at the Fed, that's fine, but we're not buying anymore. So the world is resigned from playing that game, but the U.S. has got the U.S. retirement system and the Fed to play that game, and that's why it's popping out through inflation. And the world's feeling that inflation. They may not be buying Treasuries, but they're feeling the inflation.
Would you say that this number here, the down 1/3 on the long Treasury since going direct reset, reflects the debt exploding now to $34 trillion?
No, because it's astonishing. It's only down 33%. I mean, that's what's so amazing. Right. You know, since fiscal 1998, when the financial coup started, every year I marvel at the brilliance and the ability of the machinery to keep playing this game.
Yeah.
And that's why I get very frustrated when many of my colleagues and colleagues I love in the new media say these guys are stupid. It's like, are you kidding me?
No.
No. And it's what I call the, if you read State of Our Currency, I describe this as the financial bazooka. If you look at their ability to manage and manipulate the financial bazooka, I got to tell you, my hat's off to them. They are financial geniuses. And they're really, really good. And I don't like it. I don't like it, you know, but they're really good. They know what they're doing. And it comes down to all of us. Are we going to keep financing the plunder economy? Or are we going to pull the rug out from under it? Because we have the power to pull the rug.
I'm with you. You don't do yourself any favors by underestimating your opponent.
Nope.
Saying they're stupid. They're not. They know what they're doing.
Well, I trained at their feet, right?
Yeah, right.
So one guy used to call me, he said, you're an Illuminati gopher. But the advantage of being a gopher is sometimes you're in the room and you hear, and they were good.
Yeah,
they played long ball in a way that very few people do. They thought in 100+ year increments.
Yeah, no doubt about that either. All right. Let's go to Bitcoin. Look at this monster.
I told you they were going to pump it again.
You did. You called it. So the old high was whatever, 64,000.
Yeah.
They blew through that. Anyway, it's up here.
And we have new headlines where the Brits have come out and said they reserve the right to seize crypto without a warrant. And we have the U.S. government. They did that big seizure of almost $1 billion. It's been announced that they've transferred their position. Now, you know what I had said, because I thought they were going to play another pump and dump game, and this one could go much higher. But as soon as the ETFs were approved, it was inevitable that the price starts rising strongly, because now you've got a whole bunch of ETFs. Now people can go in and buy Bitcoin by point and click at Fidelity or Vanguard. And so that's going to make, you know, on a pump, it's going to make a lot more money roll in. But now the custodians for the big ETFs need, you know, they need position. So
yeah,
we're talking about major money rolling into this market. So just remember, it's a speculation. Please, if you're swapping and trading, escrow your tax money, or you could get done what happened the last two times, which is on the dump, your tax liability is greater than the value of your whole position. So for God's sakes, please escrow your taxes if you're playing speculation on this.
Whoa, that would be bad news bears. Yep.
Okay,
let's go to Solarian House now. You mentioned The Dutch Farmers come out in PDF now. I've looked at it. It is beautiful. It's amazing.
It's beautiful. I can't wait till this comes out in hard copy. This is beautiful. Go take a look. Spread this around. It is really, really good. And if you want to understand what is happening to the European farmers, this will tell you the whole tale. And it integrates what's happening to the farmers and fishermen with the entire control grid. And you see, you know, you see the whole game whole. Else van Hamelen, a Dutch journalist, did an incredible job. But the whole Dutch team put together and recorded many interviews, many photo shoots, many conversations and interviews with farmers and fishermen. And, you know, it's just a magnificent document. So they really extended themselves. And we, for so many years, we've been getting so many questions about the Dutch farmers and fishermen, but no one's ever done this kind of quality deep dive. And, you know, here it is. This is the definitive story of what is happening.
All right, let's keep it going. In-house Larry. This is from Thomas. You mentioned dual passports. So Thomas Massey puts out a tweet and says, hey, should U.S. citizens, the dual citizens be allowed to serve as U.S. congressmen? And he gets poll results, 77,000 votes. 4% yes, 89% no, and yes, if 7% if they disclose. That's unbelievable.
So there is no disclosure of how many people in the cabinet and how many people in Congress have more than one passport. And when we interviewed Congresswoman McKinney in 2015, you know, I flew all the way to Bangladesh to interview her. And she sat down and said, if there is one reform we must have in the United States, no dual passport citizens, period. Yeah. End of discussion.
Right. That she's right on about that. Let's keep it going. Solari in-house. This one's not really in-house. This is really more of an amicus. Corey's Diggs. We put this one in because this Take Action Steps to Secure Financial Freedom is a great document because it's such an easy peasy compendium of links. So the threat to financial transaction control from Solari, BIS Blueprint, you can see all these different very useful connections on the hot issues of the day. I just thought this was, and it's Take Action too. It's coalition of attorney generals, it's lawsuits, legislation. It's a bonanza of really useful links.
It's a fabulous collection. Yeah. This is Corey and her team doing a great job again. So it's a fabulous collection of links.
Yeah. So that link will be in the PDF as usual. And now we turn to my man, Richard Verner. Here we go.
So the interview this week is so fabulous. I had sort of an eruption 2 weeks ago and I said, you know, the sound money people are at the States persuading everybody to do gold and crypto, but nobody's there pushing for dollar liquidity. And without dollar liquidity, we're going to get cornered and, you know, into a scarce resource and the land grab will work. Because the power and importance of dollar liquidity, John, is to protect us from the land grab. That's how they grab the land. They freeze the liquidity in your major currency, and then bam, you know, they've got you in a corner. So I called Richard and I said, you got to come on right away. And he had done a wonderful presentation in Malmo, Sweden in 2022 on the case for abundance. And I said, we've got to explain case of abundance and the case for dollar liquidity and enterprise and why that is such an important piece. You know, I'm a great believer that states should have gold and bullion depositories for the same reason central banks have it. But that's not going to support the broad-based economy and give people the ability to have liquid financial transactions and protect their current deposits. You can't afford to let the banks get consolidated and run. So Richard came on and did a fabulous job of making the case for state banks and all the different things the states need to do to protect transaction liquidity. It's a magnificent interview, and we made about 5 different shorties we're going to be spreading around on social media. And it's a fascinating interview. He did a great job.
Yeah, the write-up he did and the wrap-up on state banks is absolutely dynamite.
Right. It's really funny because now I can basically take a newbie and I can get them to watch several of your videos and several of Richard's videos. And the speed at which they can get out of the official narrative into reality is amazing. It's, you know, things we are we are making the case that the kind of pump and dump economics we've dealt with for generations doesn't have to be.
Right. Right. There are alternatives.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's turn closer to home. Another meetup coming up in your neck of the woods, your old stomping grounds. Here we go.
Yeah. So subscribers are meeting at the Radnor Hunt Club on March 23rd. We have tried for months and months and months to find a venue that can sort of hold our group and still be a lovely, wonderful place to gather. And finally, we had a wonderful ally who said, okay, let's go use the Radnor Hunt Club. And as you know, I stay with my cousins when I'm in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and they're great, you know, fox hunters. So we're always having fox hunting videos on the website. And I used to be a fox hunter, but if you have two payrolls, you're a little bit resistant.
Yeah.
You're a little bit resistant to going out and galloping across the countryside. But So March 23rd, and the Food for the Soul group is coming to Pennsylvania, and we're going to visit Nina Hine. And Ricardo are going to be visiting the Barnes Foundation and the Philadelphia Art Museum. I told Nina, I don't care what your cultural instincts are. We are getting a picture in front of the Rocky statue. So we're going to be doing a big recording for, we have
That's
a new
awesome.
Book coming. Yeah, we have a new a book coming out from Nina called Women in Art. We're taking all of her columns on women painters and artists and doing a book out of it. So so I don't know if you've ever been to the Barnes Foundation, but of course you're invited if you'd like to come.
If I can sneak up there, I will.
Okay.
Now, earlier you mentioned, you know, relief, personal relief to the Texas Panhandle, and here it is, batting cleanup, wildfire relief.
Right. So we looked for the best links of how to get real resources to the ranchers and check these with some of the ranchers and. And these are the best links if you want to help with the Texas Panhandle. And I would really encourage you, even if you can only give $1 or $5, some tiny amount, because the more people who give, the more message comes through. You know, we care about you. And this is a great group of people. And especially for Americans, I just think, you know, take the time to go, you know, go say a prayer and give a little bit of money, because these are people we want to send the message to, you know, we care and we're helping.
Yeah. These are real. These are Americans at their best.
Right. These are Americans at their best. Okay. Well, I believe that's it for the week, John.
Your belief like Yellen's? Your belief is correct. Hers is not.
Oh God, don't compare me to Yellen.
I just contrasted you. Your belief is correct. Hers is incorrect. There is no legal case for stealing assets. Ridiculous.
Oh, it was so hard to go from the ranchers to Yellen. It was like, oh God,
jarring. It was intended.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I come back again and again. We don't have a financial problem. We have an issue of sovereignty.
Let me ask you this: how many Texas ranchers down there? How many of them have dual passports?
Zero. Well, I shouldn't say that. There may be one I know of that might. But, you know, here's the thing. The thing that's great about all the people, you know, the ranchers I've known or the people I've known like that, a lot of them in the oil patch too, is they live the rule of law. They practice the rule of law. They take responsibility to be lawful. Their culture is a culture of trust. So, you know, my quote for the year I keep coming back to is the currency of the future will be relationships of trust.
Yeah, the rule of law is in their DNA. It would never occur to them to even behave in a way inconsistent with the rule of law.
They are remarkable about identifying people who won't and screening them out, you know, because they know all their economics depend on that kind of trust. And that kind of high cooperation. That's what beats the clock eatery. And that's what we all have to find. So, yeah, it's in their DNA. It's in their DNA.
For sure.
And so we can't let the land grabbers get away with playing them.
Absolutely no way can we let them get away with that.
Right. Okay. Well, prayers for the Panhandle. John, thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Salera Report. John and I will be back next week with what I'm sure is going to be an equally intense set of headlines for you.
Yeah, I would say a barn burner. Let's make it a bank burner. Okay.
Yeah, bank burner. Okay, bank burner. Okay. Oh, did you see the chart I just sent you? I hate to interrupt, but there's a new chart from the Wall Street Journal showing deposits and everything at community banks way up, but the total system down.
It was going to require enough thinking that it was going to delay.
Oh, no, we can, but I'm sure we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. What does this mean? Yeah. We'll talk about it next week.
Yeah. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, have a great week. See you next week.